Oh, you're all raising your hands. Okay, good. So I can see your hands all go up. So I will then assume that if you have a question during the session and you put up your hand, I will try to see you. The only problem is if you get to this morning in corporate finance, we ended up with 150 people and I can't, the way I've only a 15 in screen. So it's not like I can see everybody. So you might be better off typing in your question into the chat if you don't, but I will give people a chance to put up their hand and scan through. So, you know, we'll try it out. You know? The corporate finance session went pretty well, and it looks like this is what we're going to do, at least for this session. And thank God it's a break next week, so it'll give us a little time to catch our breath. And then the week after, when we come back, we'll still be online. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to kind of underplay the class or not do things I wouldn't have done. I mean, you paid the same tuition. I don't think NYU is giving you to your part of your tuition back. So I'm going to act like you deserve exactly the class you would have gotten in the classroom, which means I won't stop nagging you, I won't stop harassing you, with one caveat. I was planning to leave you alone for a week for the break, and I would still plan to leave you around. But next Saturday, I'll be back with a vengeance, and I think I will nag you more now that you're online than when you're in my classroom, because you need more nagging, because you know, it's easy online. I know how easy it is online to fall behind. So give it a couple more minutes or 2 more minutes and then we'll start, okay? And if you have any questions, kind of administrative questions, good time to ask now before we get started. Well, Soraya has a question that might be on your minds about if we get to the next quiz, and that's thinking way ahead because we just finished the first quiz. The next quiz is not till early April. How would we run it? There's a way to do an online quiz. In fact, I teach an online certificate class where I do a quiz. It will be, don't worry, there is a way to do it. It'll actually be online, obviously. And it'll be something which is timed. It'll be just like a regular quiz, but run with you sitting at your computer at home. So everything, as I said in the class, will move forward. So you know, we'll figure it out. Okay, so I'm going to start the class because I think we're all here, and so welcome. Now I'm glad you were able to join me there. As I said, I'm going to record this session. So if anybody was not able to join, they should be able to watch the recording. I'm going to also record on my computer and try to make it into a YouTube video. Let's see how that goes. But you know, overall, you should see the same kind of experience, you know, online as you do in person. Let's see if we can make that work. Before we ended class on Monday, I talked about the loose ends and valuation. I promised you that I would take you through a journey on these loose ends. So here's what I plan to do today. I'm going to take each of these loose ends and I'm going to spend some time talking about each of these loose ends. So we'll skip the start of the class today because, you know, it's the last class anyway, might as well skip it. So we'll start with cash. What's a conventional wisdom with cash? Don't mess with it, right? You have 100 million in cash, it's 100 million, just add it on. Today I want to start with a question. Are there conditions where you see 100 million in cash in the hands of a company and maybe discount it? Would you ever discount cash in the hands of a company or add a premium? So I'm going to start with that question. Then we're going to move on to cross-holdings. You know what cross-holdings are? These are pieces of other companies that you own. 5% of another company, 10% of another company. We're going to talk about how accounting deals with cross-holdings and how to value these cross-holdings. We'll start by looking at how you'd value these cross-holdings in a perfect world. And then we'd look at how to value these cross-holdings in the world that we live in with limited information. Then we're going to talk about other assets. So you've done a DCF valuation, you've added cash, you've dealt with cross holdings. You say, what else is there? Should I be adding anything on? It's a question that people have always asked about DCFs, and sometimes they go crazy. They go into the balance sheet and they start adding goodwill, and they start adding intangibles and other assets. We're going to lay out some ground rules on what other assets you can add and why. And then once we get to the value of the firm, I'm going to ask a question. There are some firms which are more difficult to value than others because they're more complex. Should you be discounting their value? What if there's synergy? Should you be attaching a premium? The synergy discussion we're going to hold off until we get to the M&A part. And the intangibles part as well, we'll hold off till later. But those are fundamental questions. When you talk about debt, we talked about debt in the context of cost of capital. And in the context of cost of capital, we used to narrow our definition of debt. But we revisit the question of debt again when you think about what to subtract out. Should you be subtracting out book or market value of debt? In the cost of capital calculation, it's always market value, but should the rules be different when you're subtracting out to get to value of equity? We're also going to talk about other obligations, pension fund, healthcare obligations. Increasingly, these are getting to be on balance sheet. Should you be subtracting that? Once you get to the value of equity, we'll have to address the question of control. Again, I'm going to hold off on that discussion until later in the class when we talk about acquisition valuation. And if a company is distressed, and we're facing multiple companies facing distress now, especially in the last 3 weeks, how do we bring it into our valuation? Finally, we're going to talk about management being compensated with equity. Equity in the form of restricted stock or options, it's become par for the course. It's a huge issue in many companies. What should we do about stock-based compensation? How should we deal with it in valuation? And liquidity is an issue that I'm going to delay to later. But so bulk of these issues I want to talk about today. So let's start with cash. The rule that we're always told to do with cash is if you have cash, deal with it separately. And what do I mean by that? Whether you're doing a free cash flow equity valuation or free cash flow the firm valuation, if you take the interest income out of the net income and you compute the value of equity, or you do a traditional free cash flow to the firm valuation, the interest income from cash hasn't been counted yet. So basically, you haven't counted cash. And that's why when you value a firm, you add cash. Now, there are some equity valuations where people really make a mess. They start with net income and they just take the stated net income. But that net income already includes the interest income from cash. If you compute the value of equity using net income as your starting point, you can't add cash on to that value because that would be double counting. You counted the income from the cash as part of your cash flows and now you're counting it again. In fact, with cash, the easiest way to see the difference is to look at three different companies. And I'm going to leave it, they're very simple companies. And I'm going to kind of present this to you and kind of hold off and I want you to tell me which company is which. So here are the three companies. They all have exactly the same enterprise value and the same cash balance. However, here's how they're different. Company A has a return on invested capital of 10% historically, as a cost of capital of 10%. Company B has historically had a return on capital of 5% and a cost of capital of 10%. And Company C has had a history of delivering 10% more than the cost of capital. These are all historical numbers, but file them away. The first two companies, A and B, trade in a developed market. The third company trades in an emerging market. I'm going to argue that even though all three of these companies have exactly the same cash balance, in one of these three companies, cash is going to be a neutral asset. You know what I mean by a neutral asset? $100 million in cash is going to be valued at $100. In one of these three companies, cash is going to be a wasting asset. It's going to get discounted. In one of these three companies, there's going to be a premium added on to cash. So I'm going to give you a moment to think as to which company is going to be which one. So let's start with the easy one. Which of these three companies do you think is going to be the neutral asset? So you can type it in the chat if you want. I see an A. Lots of A's. Okay, so I'm going to ask a follow-up question. What is it about Company A that makes cash a neutral asset? I agree with you, it's A. But what is it about Company A that... It is what I call a blah company. You know what blah companies do? They don't do any harm. They don't do any good. They basically run in place. And because they run in place, they can't hurt you. They can't help you. You, in a sense, are saying, look, the 100 million cash is worth 100 million. You're moving on. Okay? So that was easy. A was your neutral asset. Which of these three companies is cash a wasting asset, where you discount the cash in the hands of this company? Here I get a mixed message. I get a bunch of B's and a lot of B's and a few C's. Well, I know why you think C, right? You think emerging market, they're hiding facts from you. Maybe this is all a lie. Maybe the cash doesn't exist. Well, let's look at why B is the right answer. You know what? You know, cash by itself never hurts an investor. It's what companies can do with the cash that scares you. And what's company B's history? They have a history of stupidity. They have a history of taking bad projects. So you know what you do? You attach a stupidity discount. Now don't laugh, because it is a discount you would apply to companies you don't trust. And company B you don't trust. Now company C you might not trust for a different reason. But company C has two things that you want to consider. One is that it has a history, to the extent that you trust its return on capital, of delivering more than the cost of capital. The second is more subtle. You know, in traditional corporate finance, the utopian world from which it's born, no company needs a cash balance. Why? Because if you find a great project, here's what I assume you can do. That you can run into capital markets, raise the capital, and take the project. Why would you ever need cash? Now turn that assumption on its head. Let's say you live in a capital constrained market. Now do you see why I made this company an Argentine company? Just in the last 20 years, Argentina has probably had 4 or 5 episodes where the entire market is shut down. Shut down in what sense? You can't raise debt, you can't raise equity, capital markets have shut down. Think of what an advantage a cash balance gives you in that market. It allows you not only to keep going and take projects, it allows you to buy assets from other companies that are desperate for cash at pennies on the dollar. You have an asset, a strategic asset, and it could basically command a premium. The bottom line here is, because of the capital constraints, that $100 million cash could trade at a premium in company C. And that basically is what you have to think about when you think about the value of cash in your company. Now, as you look at those examples, I want to emphasize again why we're discounting cash in the hands of company B. It's not for the reason some analysts point to, which is that cash earns a low return. Let's concede that fact. Cash earns a low return. It earns close to 0% returns. Google last year on its $120 billion in cash earned less than a 1% return. You're saying, that's terrible. That's much lower than the cost of capital. But let me ask you a question. If you invested in something liquid and riskless, what would you earn? The answer is exactly that same number. Cash is not a wasting asset. What troubles you with cash, is that the cash could be used on projects in which you can earn the cost of capital. And that's why I call it a stupidity discount. So let's talk about whether this actually happens in markets. This is actually from one of the most interesting papers I've read. I don't read that many interesting academic papers, but this one is interesting. And this is what this paper asks. It asks, what is the market value, a dollar of cash in the hands of a company at? And it looked across all US companies. It was a very clever paper because it isolated cash and tried to estimate how much the cash was worth. Well, I'll give you the good news first. Across all US companies, a dollar in cash is valued at roughly a dollar. Why is that good news? Because that's what we do in DCF valuations. We add the entire cash balance. But when they broke the sample down into mature companies with negative excess returns, what are those companies? Low growth companies earning less than the cost of capital. Companies like Company B. A dollar in cash was actually valued at 69 cents. Think about that. That is an astonishing discount. You're a company with a bad track record and you have $10 billion in cash. I act like you have only $6.9 billion. Yeah, that's pretty scary, right? If you were giving investment advice to this company on how to increase value, what's the advice you'd give this company? They have $10 billion in cash. The market is pricing it at $6.9 billion because they don't trust the company. What's the easiest way to get rid of that $3.1 billion discount? Anybody can put it on the chat. What do they need to do? Give the cash back. Somebody said buy back, but you give the cash back. The minute you give the cash back, the discount disappears, right? Then buy back a dividend. Just give the cash back. You know how these companies fight it? And these are the companies that activist investors love. I've described Carl Icahn as not the deepest thinker on the face of the earth. A typical Carl Icahn pitch is to approach a company and say, you have too much cash, give me the cash. You can see why it works, right? A company like this, you give the cash back overnight. You don't have to take better projects. You don't have to change your business mix. You don't have to change leverage. You just have to give the cash back. Your discount disappears. Now, if you look at the final column there, it looks at high growth firms that earn well above their cost of capital. Now, these firms, you actually see your cash balance. A dollar in cash is valued at $1.22. When you see a young technology firm with a cash balance, that is a good sign, not a bad sign, because that allows the company to survive. Because you remember, most young companies run out of cash. That's how they go out of business, and especially in periods like this one. Yesterday when I was valuing Zoom, so if you get a chance, you know, you can visit my Zoom valuation. One of the things that made me feel better about Zoom was they $855 million in cash. We're going to hit some tough times in terms of raising capital in the next few months, perhaps the next couple of years. But VC money is going to dry up, public money is going to dry up. It's happened before. And the companies that have accumulated cash will have an advantage. And rather than punish them by saying you have too much cash, we have to think of it as something that helps them, given where they are in the life cycle. But so whether you discount a premium cash depends on two things: how much you trust the management of the company and whether the company is a company which faces a capital constraint. So I would not attach a discount to Google's cash, but I wouldn't attach a premium either. Google can raise as much capital as it wants no matter what the market's doing. But I would attach a premium to Zoom's cash perhaps, maybe not a huge premium, but something that says, hey, you're going to survive because of that cash. In fact, attach a 0% chance that they would fail simply for that reason. So any questions on cash before we move on to Cross Holdings? Sammy, do you have a question or is this a cue? Okay, let me see if you have, your hand up.
Hi.
Go ahead, I can hear you.
Just to clarify, so you're saying you should not look at things based on their dividends, whether giving back or not, you should not consider that?
Well, they might have given back dividends, but this is about the cash they have on the balance sheet after they've given whatever they've given. So in a sense, you can look at what they've done, but this cash balance is right now in the hands of the company. It is. So you can look at their history, but ultimately, you still have to deal with the cash that you have on your hands. So if they have a history of returning cash, you feel better about it because you say, maybe they'll return the cash, I won't discount it. So that can factor into how much of a discount you apply, but it can't be the driver.
Understood. Thank you.
Daniel, you had a question? You unmuted yourself. No? Okay. No other questions? Let's see, I'll do a very quick scan. Geez, there are too many people to actually check. So if you have a question, you might want to put it on the chat like Sammy did, and then I'll call on you because then I know where to look. Now I'm going to do a detour here. It uses what we said about cash to look at a slightly different question, but a related question. You know how mutual funds work, right? You send your money into Fidelity Magellan. What happens is the number of units in the fund goes up and the market value of the fund goes up. Your net asset value is what you pay for the fund. So typical mutual funds are called open-end mutual funds. That's what most mutual funds are. But there's a subset of mutual funds called closed-end mutual funds. You're saying, what's a closed-end mutual fund? A closed-end mutual fund is actually publicly traded. It has a market cap and its assets are all shares in publicly traded companies. So actually it should be the simplest of all companies to value, right? You own 10 assets, they're all publicly traded companies. I can see their market values and I see a market value for you. You'd expect this company to trade at roughly the market value of its holdings. It's after all transparent, you can see. So you own Coca-Cola, you know, and Wells Fargo and Washington Post, and you know what the market values are, then that's all you hold. Your stock should trade at roughly that market value. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case. One of the most enduring puzzles, and we'll see why this might not be that much of a puzzle in finance, is that a typical closed-end mutual fund trades at a discount of about 15%. On its book value. But book value is actually the market value of its holdings. That's a puzzling discount for two reasons. One is, if you can observe what people own, in this case you should be, it's a market value, why would you settle at a discount? The second is, if this discount exists, how come people are not stepping in and making a ton of money? You see what I mean by making a ton of money? You have a closed-end mutual fund, all its assets are publicly traded stocks, it's trading at a discount. What should you be able to do? I'm going to throw it out to the chat. What could you, if you wanted to make money, what could you do? bought out this company at the market value, right? And then sell all its stocks. You should be able to break up the closed-end fund and make a ton of money. There are people who actually tries it. There have been attempts to break. But two things might stop you. One is many of these closed-end funds have corporate finance, corporate governance restrictions on takeovers. The second is, in trying to liquidate the shares in the fund, you got to be careful. First, if these are small stocks which are lightly traded, there might be a discount you apply when you sell them. And second, there's a tax issue, which is if you bought these shares a while back at a much lower price and you sell them now, you have a capital gains issue. So the bottom line is closed-end fund discounts still persist and people wonder why there's a discount. And I think what we said about cash can be used to explain this. Let's assume you invest in a closed-end fund that invests in average risk stocks, stocks with a beta of 1. Let's assume that you expect average risk stocks to earn 11.5% return. That's the expected return on these stocks given the risk. But this closed-end fund underperforms the market. That's not a surprise, right? Most active investors underperform. It underperforms the market by 0.5%. Can you estimate what the discount on this fund would be? Do you see why there'd be a discount? Let's say you invested $100 in this fund. You make $11 every year, right? On an expected basis, 0.5% less than the 11.5%. You make $11 a year in perpetuity and you need to make 11.5%. You know what the present value of that $11 is going to be? It's going to come out like $96. In other words, there's going to be a 3% discount on the fund because it underperforms the market. And that has broader implications. If you look across closed-end funds, you notice that some trade at a premium, some trade at a discount. The relatively few that trade at a premium tend to be funds that have outperformed the market, and you're assuming that they can continue to do so. The ones that trade at the biggest discounts tend to be funds that have most underperformed the market. Maybe the same argument we used about discounting cash applies with closed-end funds. Now, just as an aside, you know that SoftBank now trades at 70% of book value. You're saying, what SoftBank got to do with the closed-end fund? Well, the bulk of SoftBank's value comes from its holdings in other companies, including, of course, WeWork, the most notorious, but OYO, and its most famous and its most successful holding of all time, which is Alibaba. So basically what you're getting when you buy SoftBank at 70% of book values, you're getting Alibaba at a 30% discount on its market price. You're saying, so why aren't people buying up SoftBank? Well, Master Son runs SoftBank and corporate governance is dead at the company. You don't trust SoftBank. Guess where you take it out? You take it out on the market price. Exactly the same argument we used with cash. So that's a SoftBank story, right? Now there's a flip side to it. What if you have a company that has a lot of holdings, but it's run by somebody you not only trust, but you think he's a great investor, a person who's superb at picking companies? Now, I don't want to be mysterious, but you know that Berkshire Hathaway is an insurance company with a closed-end mutual fund. Like all insurance companies, the GEICO part of Berkshire Hathaway collects insurance premiums, but unlike most insurance companies who invest those premiums in average stocks, for decades now, Berkshire Hathaway has had perhaps the most legendary investor of all time in Warren Buffett, basically going out and buying companies that he thinks are undervalued. And with his track record, he's delivered, right? And so the way this showed up is, if you look at the late 90s, for instance, Berkshire Hathaway traded at 2.6 times book value. Now, when you see an insurance company trade at 2.6 times book value, you have to remember that the book value is marked to market, and your holdings are all in public companies, it's marked to market. So in the late 90s, what you were doing when you bought Berkshire Hathaway is you were buying Coca-Cola at 100% premium, because you looked at Berkshire Hathaway, it owned Coca-Cola, the Washington Post, etc., and you were buying it at a premium. You say, why would I do that? Because you had Warren Buffett as your portfolio manager. Well, that explains why Berkshire Hathaway traded at those premiums in the late 90s. But that premium seems to have dropped off. In fact, by 2019, the price-to-book ratio for Berkshire Hathaway looked very much like the price-to-book ratio for a typical insurance company. So what's happened over the last 20 years? Why has the Buffett premium seemingly gone away? Anybody? What's different in 2020 as opposed to 1998? One is Julian says too much cash, so maybe even Buffett is not finding returns. The second is size. So I think these are all, you're right, they have a lot of cash that they can't invest. They're a much bigger company. Maybe asset prices are high. No. Sammy says maybe he's not as bright as before. Are you saying he has dementia or something? But I think Sammy is on to a good point, which is in the late 90s, when you bought Berkshire Hathaway, you bought a youthful Warren Buffett, if you can describe 60s as youthful. Today, you buy Berkshire Hathaway, you're buying a 90-year-old Warren Buffett. Mortality tells a tale, right? So even if you believe he's still a great investor, he is getting old and older. And he actually, 5 years ago, said he was not going to pick the stock. So when I heard the news about Kroger being the latest Berkshire Hathaway investment, I'm not sure that's Warren Buffett picking it or his hand-picked successors. I'm saying nothing about them, but let's face it. There's nobody who's going to be able to get the kind of the patina that Warren Buffett had as a great investor. He can't pass it on. You just can't inherit it because he picked you. So I think what you're seeing here is a passing of the guard. So it's an interesting case of how when people trust you as a mutual fund manager, you can see this show up in the premium that people are willing to pay. And here you see it play out over the long term. So, you know, all the things about, you know, the size of the company and the fact that the market is getting bigger and more driven by passive investing, all are good points. But I think the biggest one is Warren Buffett is getting older and you're discounting it. And the reality is, for the last 20 years, he's not been as successful as he was before, maybe because the market is changing. And maybe because his preferred habitat, which is old-time value investing stocks, have not done as well. So that's what I wanted to say about cash and cross holdings. Any questions before, I'm sorry, cash and closely held or, you know, funds that are closely held funds or companies like SoftBank and Berkshire Hathaway. Any questions before we move on to cross holdings? Okay, so let's move on to cross holdings. So cross holdings, you're dealing with holdings in other firms. And the first thing to deal with in cross holdings is to understand the accounting. There are three ways in which cross holdings can be accounted for. If you own 5% of another company and you take absolutely no role in how that company is run, you might be classified as a minority passive holding. You're saying, what is a minority passive holding? Here's what you're required to do. If you have a minority passive holding, that let's say it's 5%, in your income statement, you have to record the dividends you receive from those cross holdings. That's it, just the dividends. In your balance sheet, you have to reflect what you originally invested to get that 5%. You're saying, so what? Let me give you a very simple example. Since we're talking about SoftBank, let me take you back in time to the late 90s, when 70% of SoftBank's value as a company came from one cross-holding, its investment in Yahoo, whereas a venture capitalist had invested $100 million, and that $100 million had become $7 billion. It was classified as a minority passive investment. You're saying, so what? If you looked at SoftBank's income statement, what were they required to report? The dividends they received from the Yahoo holding, right? Which in the late 90s was zero. So you'd have seen nothing. You're saying, that's okay, I'll go check the balance sheet. In the balance sheet, what you'd have seen is the 50 or 100 million that they invested to get their original venture capital position. Talk about disconnect from reality. That's minority passive holdings. Thank God minority passive holdings are not used that often. Most often, when you own 10 or 20% of a company, you're required to use what's called the equity approach in minority active holdings. Here's what you're required to do with the equity approach. Let's say you own 20% of a company, it's been classified as a minority active holding, either because the percentage is high or because you take some role in how the company is run. In your income statement, you're required to show below the operating income line, and this is key, below the operating income line, 20% of the net income or net loss from the cross-holding. Better than dividends, right? Because at least now you're seeing the income show up. And in your balance sheet, you have to show the original amount you invested plus or minus 20% of all the retained earnings since. So it's like an updated book value. So minority active is better than minority passive because of that. Then finally, let's say you own 60% of a company. Accountants flip out, right? Because with 60% of a company, what are you required to do? You're required to consolidate. I'll be quite honest, I've never understood the logic. I own 60% of a company, you make me act like I own 100%. So when I do my income statement, I have to count 100% of the revenues, 100% of the operating income. And when I do my balance sheet, I have to show 100% of the assets, 100% of the cash. And at every step I'm saying, but I own only 60%. And you as the accountant say, don't worry about it. The last moment you wake up and say, but you own only 60%. You think that's what I've been trying to tell you all this time. Say, you don't own 40%. You say, duh. And you take the 40% that doesn't belong to me. And you know what you show on the balance sheet? On the liability side, you see an item called minority interest or non-controlling interest. You know what that reflects? The 40% that doesn't belong to you. Why is it there? Because they counted 100% when you owned only 60%. Talk about creating trouble for yourself. So the first thing you need to do when you look at across holdings is to figure out how it's recorded. Is it recorded as a minority passive holding, a minority active holding, or a majority active holding? Because they all have different consequences. You're saying, how would I know? Here's a simple test. First, if there's a majority holding, look at the balance sheet and see if it says consolidated. Then look on the liability side and see if it says minority interest or non-controlling interest. Then you have a majority active holding. If you have a minority holding, look at your income statement. If you see a percentage of your subsidiary's income or loss, then you have a minority active holding. Start with that before you get ambitious and start valuing them. So let's talk about valuing cross holdings with a very simple example. Okay? So I have your chat ready because I'm going to put this to you. So let's assume you valued a company. Let's call it Company A with the consolidated financials. That's an important word. Consolidated financials for a billion. What do I do with consolidated financials? I take the operating income and use it to derive a free cash flow to the firm, and I discount them back at the cost of capital to come up with the value. I subtract out the $200 million in debt that they have, and the value of my equity in Company A is $800 million, right? So I'll answer question one for you. Company A's equity is worth $800 million. Now I'm going to add two pieces of information, and I'd like you to tell me how this will affect your equity value. So now I tell you that Company A owns 10% of Company B, and the holdings are accounted as passive holdings. If the market cap of Company B is $500 million, how much of is the equity in Company A worth? Remember, you've already come up with $800 million. Now I've thrown this additional piece of information. The question I'm asking you is, will it increase my value, decrease my value, or leave it unchanged? So I'm going to give you a minute to think about it. So $800 million was my value before. Now I've told you they own 10% of Company B and the holdings are minority holdings. The market cap is $500 million. What's your updated value for equity? Increase $850 million. That's exactly right. And let's see why. First, why am I adding this? Remember, when I did a consolidated valuation, I used the operating income on the income statement. And that operating income, that did not include any of the income from my minority holdings. Why they were treated as passive holdings? They show up below the operating income line. So when I do a traditional discounted cash flow valuation using free cash flow of the firm and cost of capital, if I own small pieces of other companies and they're recorded as minority holdings, I need to value those holdings separately and bring them in. I've used the market cap of Company B here as my basis for valuing the holdings. So that'll be 10% of $500 million. But that's a little bit of cheating, right? Because in intrinsic value, you're supposed to do this yourself. But at least here, I'm taking the market cap saying, please God, let it be okay. 10% of $500 million is $50 million. 800 plus 50 is $850 million. So we've got an updated value of equity of $850 million. Everybody with me so far? If you don't agree with that, just, you know, kind of stop me, because I want to make sure everybody gets this. Cross holdings are the trickiest part of DCF. I want to make sure that you're on board. Okay. Now let me add another piece of information. Let's suppose I forgot to mention that Company A owns 60% of Company C and the holdings are fully consolidated. On the balance sheet, the minority interest is recorded at $40 million for the Company C minority interest. Now I have an updated question. My value after I asked you about Company B was $850 million, right? Now I've told you that they own 60% of Company C, and I've thrown this minority interest of $40 million from the balance sheet. So again, I'm going to ask you the question, what do I do with the $40 million? There are three choices. I can ignore it, I can add it, or I can subtract it. subtract, 8 tens, 8 tens. So I see a lot of 8 tens in subtract and think of why. Why are we subtracting it? Because when I did my valuation, I counted 100% of company C as part of my operating income, but I own only 60%. I need to net out the 40 million. But here again, I'm cheating. You know why I'm cheating? What's minority interest recorded at? Who records that? It's accountants, right? That 40 million that you see on the balance sheet is a book value. I created a complete and total mess in this process. I started with an intrinsic value of 800 million. Then I added 50 million, which is based on a market pricing. Then I'm subtracting out 40 million based on a book value. So let me ask you a question. If you wanted to do this right, what would you need to do with company B and company C? If you wanted to make this a truly intrinsic valuation, what would you need to do with company B and company C? One is you can try unconsolidating, but that's a lot of work. Let's say you could not unconsolidate. Gabe's recommendation is a good one. Unconsolidate, do the parent company. Let's say you could not. You're stuck with consolidated. You go to the next page. What if I could do an intrinsic valuation of company B and company C? You see where I'm going? I say, look, I don't trust the market. I don't trust accountants. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to value the equity in company B and I'm going to value the equity in company C. Let's say my intrinsic valuation of company B was 250 million and the intrinsic valuation of company C was 250 million. Now, how would you update the value of equity? Let's go back to the 800 million you had before. What's 10% of company B worth based on intrinsic value? 25 million, right? So 800 plus 25. Now, last step, I'm going to ask you, what do I need to do to net out the 40% that doesn't belong to me? So I'm at 825 after I brought in company B's intrinsic value. What's the last step? Subtract 25. Remember, I don't own 40% of company C. Subtract 100, exactly. So basically, I subtract out 100. Not 150, not 25, but 100, because I subtract out what doesn't belong to me. Now do you see why cross holdings are complete and total, I don't want to say, I might as well say it's online, it's a shit show. I see valuations of companies where people do all kinds of crap with cross holdings. If you're truly doing intrinsic valuation, you really should be valuing each subsidiary. So I'll give you in a perfect world what I do, but I'd actually take Gabe's suggestion, because what I did where I started with a consolidated company, it's already tricky because I have two companies, two different businesses, who knows how they're growing. In a perfect world, I would look for parent company financials. Parent company financials have no cross holdings in them. I'd value the parent company first. Then I'd take each subsidiary and I would value the subsidiary using the intrinsic value of each one and take the percentage of each one that belongs to me. So the example that I gave you, I value the parent company, company A, with just its parent company financials. My value would not be 800 million, it would be some other number because I'd have to use the parent company numbers. Then I'd value company B and take 10% of that, and company C and take 60% of that, because there I'm building off parent company numbers. In a perfect world, that's how I'd value every company with cross holdings. I'll tell you when I've come closest to the perfect world. A few years ago, I valued Yahoo. This was in 2013, maybe 2 years after Marissa Mayer became CEO. Now, I initially valued Yahoo's operating assets. Now, let me ask you a question. How much would you value a search engine that nobody searches on with a mail program that only 70-year-olds use? The answer was not much. I came up with the value for their operating assets of about $7.3 billion for their equity. So if I'd stopped that, that would have been the value of equity in Yahoo based on its parent company financials. But it had two big cross holdings in 2013. This might have been 2014. It was right after the Alibaba IPO. One was 21% of Alibaba and the other was, 22% of Alibaba and the other was 35% of Yahoo Japan. And here I had full financial statements for both those companies. For Yahoo Japan, because it's actually a separately traded company, and Alibaba, because it had just filed its prospectus. So here's what I did. I did a full intrinsic value of Yahoo Japan and a full intrinsic value of Alibaba equity. I even netted out the taxes that we do if they had to sell a portion of the equity, which Alibaba's IPO actually required them to do. and came up with an equity value per share of about $42 per share. I'm sorry, $41 per share. Stock was trading at 37. On valued as a combined business, you could see where the value was coming from. But here I was able to do what I wanted to do because I had full access to financials on all three companies. In the real world, that's going to get a little more difficult, and let me explain why. And I'll give you a story to tell you why. About 20 plus years ago, I was updating one of my valuation books, and I was valuing a Japanese company. And the Japanese companies in the late 90s, you're always teetering on the edge of disaster, because if you made one misstep, because risk-free rates were so low there relative to the rest of the world, the whole valuation would blow up. So I was pretty careful. I finished my DCF, and then I start looking at the annual report to see if there's something else I might have missed. And I come to a page and they list 226 cross holdings. 226 cross holdings. Well, job is laid out for me, right? Because if I wanted to do this right now, to value this one company, I'd have to do full intrinsic valuations of 226 other companies. I'm an extremely lazy person. I would never do that. But even if I wanted to, I could not have done it in this case for a simple reason. 160 of those companies, roughly speaking, were private businesses with zero information provided. Nothing. No revenues, no earnings, nothing. The other 66 were public companies, but the 160 I could have done nothing about. So I called the investment relations officer of this Japanese company and said, look, I'm valuing a company, it's not for an expose. Can you give me some information on these cross holdings? And she said, I cannot give you that information. And I said, why not? Because she said it's proprietary. The way she said proprietary was kind of scary, but no, I kind of persisted. So, but I said, what if I bought 1,000 shares in the company and then called her? She said, it would still be proprietary. And I said, no, but that doesn't make any sense because I'm a part owner of your company and you're refusing to tell me what I own. She thought about it for a moment. She said, you have a point, but it's still proprietary. This point, I'm banging my head against a brick wall. I get ready to hang up the phone, and she says, wait, I do have something I can tell you about these subsidiaries. So I'm saying, hopefully she's going to give me some operating information, maybe revenues, maybe operating income. And I said, what? And she said, I cannot give you specifics, but I have to tell you, they're worth a lot. I said, let me be specific here. So you want me to enter this Excel spreadsheet cell that I have for your minority holdings, a lot? LOT, it's not working for me. It's giving me an error message. But it kind of cuts to the heart of the cross-holding culture, right? Because here's what managers think they can do. They think they can hold up a brown paper bag and say, trust me, it's full of cash. And you say, look, can I look in the bag? I say, no, trust me, it's full of cash. And I'll tell you how much cash is in there. And that's exactly what we let companies with cross-holdings do. Tell us how much the cross-holdings are worth. And as long as we take their word for it, why are they ever, ever, ever going to let us look inside the bag? So the real world, often companies hold back information on cross holdings, especially in private businesses. And your job then is to try to get your best estimate for those cross holdings. So here's a shortcut I use. Let's say you have a steel company that owns, a portion of it owns 60% of a chemical company, and it says minority interest is $100 million in that chemical company. A minority interest is a book value, right? It reflects the 40% that doesn't belong to you. But what if I told you that chemical companies traded 2x book value? I can find that out by looking at the market. You know what I'd subtract out for minority interest? Not the 100 million book value, but 100 million times 2, 200 million, my estimated market value. It's a very rough approximation, but it does reasonably well in converting book value to market value. So try it out. When you have a lot of cross holdings, see if you can value, especially if it's a big cross holding. You might want to value that piece. If I were valuing SoftBank, I'd value Alibaba too, because when 25% of your value comes from one cross-holding, it's worth doing it. But a lot of small cross-holdings, use the approximation of the price to book on book value, or price earnings on earnings, or use something to convert what you see as information into estimated market value. So let's finish this, and then I'll come back to the because there was a question from Julian on Yahoo and Alibaba, and I'll come back to that now. So let's now talk about what happens with Yahoo if I hadn't had that information. Remember, until 2014, before Alibaba went public, I could not have done what I did in my intrinsic valuation. So actually try the pricing of Yahoo. Remember what we talked about with pricing? When you price something, you look at what other people are paying for similar companies. So I started by pricing Yahoo equity using a enterprise value to sales multiple. Then I took Yahoo Japan and priced it. And I took Alibaba and priced it. And I took a pricing approach. I got a price per share pretty close to Yahoo. But sometimes you might not be able to do intrinsic valuation. So when you use price to book, you're essentially pricing your cross-holding and hoping it gives you a value. Now, one of the questions Julian had was, you know, Yahoo's return on capital and Alibaba's return on capital actually doesn't even enter the equation because Alibaba's market value can be whatever it is. My point is, in the hands of SoftBank, you're discounting that value because it's not Alibaba that you don't trust, it's SoftBank. Because tomorrow, SoftBank could liquidate its Alibaba holding and double its OYO holding. You don't control that. And to the extent that you don't trust Master Son, you're discounting SoftBank. So I'm going to pause there for cross holdings and open up for questions. So any questions on cross holdings? Okay, so let's keep moving. Let's talk about what else you might be able to add on to your DCF value. I'll be careful about what you add on because there's a heck of a lot of double counting that happens in valuation where people do a DCF, then add on stuff like, and I've seen people value an oil company with a DCF model, then add the value of the refineries and the ships. You can't do that. You cannot count an asset twice. You can't count it once in your cash flows and yet again by adding the assets that produce those cash flows. That's why when you value a bank, you can't value the bank and then say the headquarters building is in Manhattan, it's worth $1 billion. I'll add the billion on to my discounted cash flow valuation. Discounted cash flow valuation counts the cash flows. You cannot count an asset twice. So what can you count? Well, in the late 90s, when lots of companies had overfunded pension plans. In the US, you get an overfunded pension plan if you have a guaranteed pension. So fewer and fewer of these companies. Analysts said, well, that technically belongs to equity research, equity investors, so we're going to add it on. That's such a stretch, I wouldn't even go there. But there are some unutilized assets which will never be utilized that really are not even part of this company's core business. Don't ask me how the company acquired them in the first place, but that you own technically as shareholders that you might want to add on. So I'll give you a kind of over-the-top example, and hopefully it'll stick with your head when you think about what else should I be adding on. I don't know whether any of you are part of the Michael Price Fund. Now, if you are, you don't have to put up your hand. It's, you know what it is, right? It's basically the fund that MBAs get to run. And it's been around for about 20 years. And I've never had any official role to play with the fund. But people once in a while, if they're part of the fund, come by and test their pitches on me. So what do you think about this one? So about 12 years ago, I'm sitting in my office. One of the MBAs who's in my valuation class as well comes in. He's part of the fund. And he said, now, I'm facing a conundrum. I very quickly turned to my computer, typed the word conundrum to see what exactly he was talking about, and it turns out he was confused. I didn't know why he didn't just say I was confused. So I said, what's your conundrum? I liked the words. I thought I'd use it as many times as I could. And he said, my conundrum is I'm valuing Playboy. And I said, I don't see a conundrum yet. He said, I valued it at $240 million. It's priced at $280 million. I said, I still don't see a conundrum. It's overvalued. Just let it be. He said, my conundrum, see how many times we've used the word conundrum in 2 minutes? He said, my conundrum is Playboy has one very valuable asset that I haven't counted in my DCF valuation. You know what he was talking about? Anybody have a guess? You get your mind out of the gutter. It's not the bunnies. The bunnies are already in the cash flows. It's not the magazine. It's not you have. It's the Playboy Mansion. Exactly. The Playboy Mansion technically belongs to Playboy, the company. It's one of the most valuable pieces of real estate in LA. It was worth at that time, but the time this MBA had come in and talked to me, about $100 million. You know, the question he was asking was, if I add the $100 million, it belongs to Playboy, the company, I come up with $340 million, it looks undervalued, can I add the mansion? And I said, you do have a problem. And the problem is, there's an 85-year-old in a bathrobe hanging out in the mansion. You can't exactly evict him. And, you know, I'm talking about Hugh Hefner. And he said, what should I do? And I said, why don't you check the actuarial tables? And he asked, what should I check for? And I said, check to see how long 85-year-olds in bathrobes tend to live when they're surrounded by 26-year-old playmates. And the answer is not that long. How about 5 years? You know what you need to do next, right? You need to take the $100 million or estimate price for the real estate, discount it back 5 years. You can use a real estate cost of capital if that makes you feel better. And then add that to the $240 million. I forgot all about that conversation until a few years ago. I open up the Wall Street Journal and I see a new story, and Playboy has come up with this incredibly creative way to have their cake and eat it too. They sold the mansion for $200 million with Hugh Hefner in it. I'm not kidding. They sold it to this Greek billionaire, Darren Metropoulos. He bought the mansion with a condition. The condition was that Hugh Hefner could continue to live in the mansion until he died, and then Darren would get it. Okay? That's a clever way to convert your asset to cash. But it's becoming, this issue of assets under your business are becoming more of a factor in Asia, especially where real estate values are shooting up so much that there are businesses where if you value them based on a DCF, you come up with a value, but the real estate they're sitting on is worth so much that they're worth more as real estate than as value. But I can't add those two numbers up. You cannot, in most cases, have your cake and eat it too. This is an exception where essentially I am able to have my cake and eat it too, and that $200 million would get added on to my DCF value. So that's other assets. Any questions about other assets? Okay, since we're chugging right along, let's move on to the next loose end. Let's suppose I came to you with two companies. So I'll give you the facts on these two companies. The numbers look exactly the same. Same operating income, same tax rate, same return on capital, same growth rate, same cost of capital, right? But here's where they're different. Company A is in a single business, has a very simple holding structure, and is transparent accounting. It's easy to understand what the company does, and the numbers basically speak for themselves. Company B is in multiple businesses, has a complex holding structure, and the accounting is opaque. You're saying, what's opaque accounting? It's one of those annual reports you open up and it claims to be in English, and you read it, you're not sure what language it's in. So here's my question to you as an investor. The numbers look the same at both companies, but which company would you value slash price more highly? Company A or Company B? The simple company or the complex company? I see a bunch of A's. Good. Okay. So are we in consensus, A? Well, here's the problem. Now, you open up my book or you take even this class and you start plugging numbers into a DCF model. As I said, the numbers are exactly the same, right? What's a DCF model going to give you as a value for both companies? It's going to give you the same value. I'll tell you when this became an issue in the valuation class. It was in, I think, the 2000-2001 valuation class. And Tyco had just had an accounting scandal and the company had blown up, maybe 2004. The company had blown up. Now, when the accounting scandal hit, Tyco lost almost 60-70% of its value. But what made it interesting was GE lost 15% of the value. So basically, of Tyco losing 60% because it's an accounting scandal, and people are asking, why is GE being punished? Now, and the answer was Tyco was a conglomerate that grew through acquisitions, hid a lot of bad stuff behind the mix, and it got away with holding back with information that you should have known. So we're punishing GE because it looked like Tyco. And I asked my class, well, you know, guys, should we be measuring complexity of companies and punishing complex companies? Is there something we should be doing? And everybody kind of agreed that there should be something we do in DCF to punish companies that are truly messy. Incidentally, Juliet asked a good question, which is, if there's a product mix that hedges against each other, should it help? Remember, if you're a diversified investor, what companies do to diversify doesn't help you. You could have done it yourself. So none of the stuff that companies do internally is creating any value to investors who are diversified, because they can do it far more cheaply and far more efficiently. So I threw this question out, and they all agreed that, and I said, okay, if we want to do this, there are two questions we need to answer. First is, we need to answer, what is a complex company? We need to measure complexity. And second, we need to find a way to bring that measure into our numbers. They all agreed that we needed to answer the two questions. They said, you're teaching a class. When do you come up with a measure of complexity? Okay, they put it back in my lap. I came back the next session with my first measure of complexity. And they weren't impressed. Here's what I did. I just counted the number of pages in the 10K and the 10Q. I know, incredibly unsophisticated, but let me ask you a question. In 2004, if I gave you a company to value, which of these 10 companies would you least want to value? To me, it's no contest. Look at Citigroup. 1,026 pages in a 10K. This isn't War and Peace. This is how many pages it takes them to tell me what happened last year. It takes you 1,000 pages to tell me what happened last year. You're one heck of a screwed up company. So I put this up, and my class was not impressed, and they said, we're not spending at that point in time, it was only $125,000 for an MBA to count pages. We'd like something more sophisticated. And I said, you're right. What was I thinking? I'll be back next session. I came back next session with what I call my valuation shit list. It's just a technical term for all the things that bug me when I value a company and how much they bug me. I'll give you examples of things that bug me. When you see a company claiming to be in multiple businesses, but they don't break things down by business very well. When they tell me they operate geographically in multiple locations, but they don't specify where. Or they specify where, and I'm not sure what part of the world that is. I'll give you one of my examples. A long time ago, I was valuing BMW, and in my valuation, I wanted to check to see where they get the revenues. And they break the revenues down. Europe, North America, South America, Africa, Asia, and then Oceania. And I'm trying to think of my geography class. Where the heck is Oceania? And I'm thinking, maybe it's the lost continent of Atlantis. Maybe they're selling cars there. So finally, I give up and I call the BMW investment relations officer and I said, you know what, I'm valuing BMW. Could you tell me where Oceania is? And she said, Australia, New Zealand, and Indonesia. And I said, what do they have in common? She said, they're by an ocean. I said, really? That's your definition of Oceania? Because if I use that definition, 80% of the world would be Oceania. What am I left with? Latvia? Some landlocked country? And if you think from a valuation perspective why this is a problem, if you tell me you get 13% of your revenues from Australia and Indonesia, think of why this makes valuation difficult. Remember we said that to compute the equity risk premium for a company, you look at where they operate? You combine Australia, which is a market with a AAA rating with an equity risk premium, very much like the US, with Indonesia, which is not a AAA rated country, and you don't tell me how much you get from each. How the heck do I deal with this? So I took issues like this and I built up a spreadsheet, and this is subjective. This is how much these things bug me when I value a company, and I built up a score. The higher the score, the more complex the company. So I went through this in my MBA class in 2004, and I said, do you guys like this more? And they said, yeah, this is much better. This is so much more sophisticated. You know, this is why we're coming back for an MBA. And I said, that's good, but there's one small cost to coming up with this complexity score. To get the score for Citigroup, what do I need to do? I need to read 1,026 pages, right? And I said, I'm not doing that. I'm too lazy. But each of you is running a company this semester, right? And they could see the train coming at them down the tracks. Too late to get out of the way now. They said, yes. And I said, this semester, in addition to doing a full project valuation, why don't you do a complexity score for your company as well? It wasn't really a question. It was an edict. And they bitched and they moaned. But what choice did they have? I mean, they should have just taken my number of pages suggestion the previous session and just run with it. That semester, for the 300 companies that they computed the complexity score for, we learned some interesting things. First, there was almost no correlation between company size and complexity. I thought large companies would be complex and small companies would be simple. No, there was no such connection. There were large companies that were incredibly simple and small companies were incredibly complex. Second, emerging market companies were about 20 to 25% more complex than developed market companies, largely because of the cross-holding culture. Third, companies that grew with acquisitions were significantly more complex. If any of you have picked companies that grow through acquisitions, you've already run into the issues because the investments are lumpy, you have goodwill kind of throwing wrench in the works. It's messy. They're about 40% more difficult to value. And finally, if you have a company with a financing arm in it, you know what I'm talking about? Volkswagen and Volkswagen Capital, GM and GMAC. Basically, a bank embedded in the middle of a company, it makes your valuation much more difficult. And in fact, that semester, the company that came out as most transparent, least complex, was an Indian company called Infosys, which should cast as a lie when emerging market companies, and I do this session, when I do this part with emerging market company CFOs, their defense about for being complex is, hey, don't blame us, we're Indonesian companies, and in Indonesia, the information disclosure laws are not that strong. As if information disclosure laws put a ceiling on what you can reveal rather than a floor. If you choose to be transparent, I don't care where you are in the world, you can. If you choose to be complex, you will be. So the most transparent company was Infosys. I want you to guess what the most complex company was in 2004, given all the pieces that I described, right? You're in multiple businesses, multiple countries, you do a lot of acquisitions, you have a financing arm embedded in you. If I were designing a company for hell, you know, hell has a lot of bankers who do valuation. If I wanted to create a company that would really make life difficult for you, what would that company have been in 2004? It was GE. Enron was already gone. Enron was not complex. It was just a scam. Now, somebody said Citi and Lehman, those are fine. But those, you know, and I'll talk about financial service companies in general. It would have been GE. And those were the glory days for GE, if you think about it. I think it was at that time the largest market cap company. But it terrified me because of how much we did not know. In fact, I'll tell you why. In traditional finance, we've assumed that what you don't know can be ignored. Why my books basically have nothing for complexity in. We make a very dangerous assumption that what you don't know will get averaged out. It's a diversification argument. The only problem is what you don't know about complex companies is what managers have chosen not to tell you. So let me ask you a question. What do managers hold back? Good news or bad news? Or let me ask you a different question. What was the last accounting scandal you read about where a company came out and said, you know what, guys, we made 5 times more money than we told you we did? Notice that scandals always seem to cut in one direction. Surprises are almost always negative surprises. So with GE, we've discovered in hindsight how much trouble there was embedded in the company. But when you invest in a complex company, think of this. When you think about pulling the trigger on this company looks cheap, I'm going to go out and invest in a company, that complexity might hold you back. Another factor that SoftBank has weighing against it. So let's talk about how to bring complexity in. Let's take the two extreme scenarios. There are some analysts who, once bitten by that scandal, say never again, and they basically steer away from any company which has, you know, complexity. They say, I'll buy just simple companies, and if I can't see what I want to see, then I'm not, and that's fine, but then there are going to be a whole chunk of companies. You can never invest in a money center bank if you did this, because as I'll say in a couple of minutes, money center banks have complexity built into them. You could be the conservative analyst who says, I want value what I can't see. No, or you could be the aggressive analyst. In good times, people just ignore complexity. They just say, oh, it doesn't matter. So if you're a conservative analyst, you ignore things you can't value. You're an aggressive analyst, you just take manager's word for whatever they tell you. But I think the middle ground, I think, is the most sensible one. You got to find a number. Remember the it proposition? If I want to show complexity in value, I have to find something in my DCF to reflect it. I can try to adjust my cash flows, make the cash flows for more complex companies lower. Almost arbitrarily haircut them. And the word arbitrarily already scares me. So I'm going to steer away from that. I can try to increase the discount for complex companies. And here there's something I could do. Remember how I computed the equity risk premium for the S&P 500? Well, as part of this analysis on complexity, remember I spent a month on each of these loose ends, I actually broke the S&P 500 into two halves. A simple half and a complex half, a lot of subjective judgment calls there. And then I computed the implied cost of equity for each half. You see what I'm trying to estimate? I'm trying to estimate whether markets demand a higher cost of equity for complex companies. And what I found was that complex companies had a cost of equity about 1% higher than simple companies. How would I use this? Now, value a complex company, I'll take risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium, but if it's a complex company, add this complexity premium. And I've got to keep re-estimating it from the market every year to make sure I'm capturing what the market is punishing complex companies for. Finally, as almost a throwaway in this part of the analysis, I also ran a regression of price-to-book ratios. And if you never run a regression, just hang in there. for the 100 largest market cap stocks in the US against return on equity, beta, and growth rate, which are three fairly standard variables. We'll come back and talk more about this in about 8 or 9 sessions. But then I threw the number of pages in the 10K into that regression. And I got a coefficient of -0.004, and the coefficient was statistically significant. You say, what does that mean? Every 100 additional pages in your 10K seem to knock your price-to-book ratio down by about, I think it's 0.3, not 0.4. Let me make sure. 0.3. 0.3 up. So let's play a game. Let's suppose I'm Citigroup. My price-to-book ratio is 0.9. You're a consultant. I come to you and say, look, I want to double my price-to-book ratio. What would your advice be to me? Knock 300 pages off your 10K, right? Sounds facetious. But think of why Citigroup has 1,000 pages in its 10K. It's not accidental. I can trace it back to a day in 1998 when John Reed stood next to Sandy Weill and they announced they were going to create the largest financial supermarket in the world. And they succeeded, right? Insurance company, real estate company, bank, investment bank, all rolled into one. They created this complex company. It wasn't accidental. And in fact, that's a good point to make about all money center banks now. I believe since 2008, money center banks have not only been, they've always been complex, but since 2008, people have given up on them. You know, the return on equity of money center banks has gone back close to where it was, maybe not to 2007 levels, but not much higher than it was in 2009, 2010. But price to book ratios have stayed stagnant. They dropped and they've stayed low. Why? Because investors don't trust banks. And can you blame them? There's so much in a big money center bank you don't know about. The only way you find out is with a scandal every 2 or 3 years. Money center banks, I think, are being discounted. And if Jamie Dimon ever asked me for advice, and he never would, I'd say break JP Morgan up into 5 pieces. And I think that JP Morgan would be worth more as 5 pieces than it is as one company, because the complexity is weighing down the other pieces. Something to think about when you think about some of the parts is, you know, money center banks might be one of the places we want to get started. Now let's talk about debt. Now when you talk about debt in the context, the three criteria we go looking for debt is there a contractual commitment? Is it tax deductible? And if you fail to make it, bad things can happen to you. This is how we define debt when we talked about cost of capital. And in cost of capital, all interest-bearing debt and lease commitments were included in debt. But with cost of capital, I said keep your debt definition narrow. Don't start adding underfunded pension obligations or accounts payable because you want to be conservative. Because in the process, you will push up your debt ratio and push down your cost of capital. That's the opposite of being conservative. So when you do cost of capital, your definition of debt has to be narrow. But when you get to that last stage of subtracting out debt, then you might want to rethink your definition of debt. Let's give one example of rethinking. Let's assume you've done a DCF valuation of a company that's in deep distress. You come up with a value of $1 billion for the operating assets. This company has $1 billion in face value of debt, but because it's distressed, the market value of this debt is only $500 million. You're thinking about investing in the equity in this company. What's the equity worth? And I'll give you two choices. One is zero, which is what you get if you subtract out the billion from the billion of $500 million. You know what traditional DCF valuation textbooks would tell you to do, right? Subtract out the market value of debt. And most of the time it works. But do you see the danger you'd be exposed to as an equity investor if you went and paid $500 million for this equity? The only reason the equity has value is because the lenders think it might, the company can go bankrupt. If in the process of buying the equity, you make that fear go away. So let's say you're an acquirer and you are a healthy company acquiring this distressed company for $500 million. The minute you acquire this company, lenders say, this is great, I'm going to be paid now, and the $500 million will bounce back to $1 billion. So what should I do with a DCF valuation? You might want to compute both those numbers and think of your value of equity as falling somewhere between those two numbers, depending on how close to actual distress this company is. And if you truly get to liquidation, which is at the end stages of distress, then you should be subtracting out the book value because you really have no choice. Lenders are not going to accept a discount on the book value, on their face value of debt, just because you say, look guys, I can't, you know, the market value is lower than the book value. So I know I've given a confusing answer, but traditionally in DCF valuation, we subtract out the market value of debt. But if you have a deeply distressed company, you might want to also subtract out the face value and get a range on your equity. Now, somebody had asked me about the conglomerate discount. The conglomerate discount is a very lazy number that's often thrown around by both academics and practitioners, which is if you have a conglomerate, there's a discount on the sum of the parts. There are two problems with that. One is the sum of the parts are actually not valued. They're all priced. So the way an analyst comes up with the sum of the parts is they'll take each part and look at the EBITDA for each part, apply a multiple, and then they will compare the market cap to that sum of the parts. And they'll say, well, traditionally, conglomerates trade at a 7 to 10% discount. So to begin with, it's not even clear there's a discount. But if there's a discount, this could be one reason for that, is the complexity of the companies makes it so difficult to value these companies. A lot of family group companies in India have a tremendous discount on their holding, because often they're a holding company for publicly traded companies. And one reason for that might be the complexity that these family group companies create in the way they're structured that makes it so difficult for people to see what they own. Right? One final point about debt. This is your last chance to deal with any other troubles that you might want to worry about. So I'll give you an example of things that you know that you might want to factor in. If you have an underfunded pension fund obligation or a healthcare obligation, it's not debt for a cost of capital calculation. But if you think about it as an equity investor and you say this company has to come up with $7 billion in additional money to cover pension funds, you might want to subtract it out unless you can get the government to pick it off you. And then many companies try to do this. And if you're the target of a lawsuit, this is your last chance to deal with it. I'll give you a very specific example. Let's suppose you're valuing Bayer, the German company, and one of the problems, and you get a DCF value. If any of you value Bayer, you find it to be significantly undervalued. I'll save you the trouble. But before you buy it, you know what's hanging over Bayer's head, right? Those roundup lawsuits from the Monsanto acquisition. You know it's going to cost the money. You don't know how much. You're saying, what do I do? Get a good trial lawyer friend, because this is not a financial question anymore, it's a legal question. And you're trying to figure out what the end game here will be of what will happen once those lawsuits get played out. And remember, companies like John Manville, which made asbestos, the end game was the lawsuits wiped out the company. With tobacco companies, the end game ended up being more benign. They ended up managing to get a negotiated cost, which was much lower than what people thought would be. So this becomes a key part of assessing the value of equity if you have a company that's been targeted in a lawsuit. Any questions on the debt issue? Okay, so let's do the last loose end. So basically, the last thing I want to talk about is the fact that increasingly companies pay their employees with equity, with restricted stock or options. So I'm going to start with a question, which is going to cut to the chase of how we should deal with this. I know this year might be different from last year with all this turmoil going on, but Amazon, I think, was one of the largest employers of Stern MBAs last year. And you see a lot of young tech companies coming on board, to hire MBAs. Why? And many of those companies, when they compete with the Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or McKinsey, can't afford to pay as much as those companies do in cash. They don't have that much cash. The way they make up for it is they give you options or they give you an equity stake. In other words, the reasons companies use stock-based compensation is not to get incentives lined up. That might be a side benefit because they don't have the cash. It is wages and compensation delivered in the form of stock because these companies don't have the cash. And that's going to color how I think about employee-based compensation. So there are two questions I want to deal with. One is, any restricted stock or option that a company might have given in the past, how do I factor that in? And the second is, what about expectations that this company will continue to give stock-based compensation in the future? So let's start with the first of those questions. Now let's start with restricted stock, because restricted stock is the easier problem. If your company has granted restricted shares, and is everybody clear on what the restriction on these shares is? You go to work for these companies, they'll give you shares in the company. The restriction will be that you cannot sell these shares for 3 to 5 years. There's an illiquidity built into them. So which means that they're worth less than non-restricted shares, but their shares outstanding. So when you have a company with restricted shares, and almost every young company that's gone public in the last 3 years had restricted shares, my advice is take those shares, add them to your share count. So don't let them play any games with you. Add them to the share count, vested or non-vested, and count it as shares today and move on. So if you have restricted stocks that have already been granted, then just count it in the share count. If you expect the company to keep giving restricted shares as part of the compensation, then count it as part of expenses in the future, which will lower your future cash flows and your DCF value. Sounds like you're punishing the company twice, but you're actually punishing for two different things. One is for restricted stock issues in the past, and the other is for restricted stock issues in the future. The more difficult problem is when companies grant options. And options affect your value because employees are given the right to buy shares at a fixed price. You're saying, so what? No, anybody can buy shares. That fixed price, the options get exercised only if you get the right to buy a share at a discount on the current market price. So the nature of options is they dilute your value in the process of exercise. Why? Because when people exercise the options, they're actually buying the shares at a discounted price relative to what you paid. So when people exercise options, and there are a lot of options outstanding, their price per share is going to drop. And options affect equity value even before exercise because you have to build in that expected likelihood that there will be exercise. So I'm going to use a very simple example to illustrate this process. Let's say you're valuing a company. You have $100 million in free cash flows and you have a cost to capital of 8%. So if you take 100 million and let's say you have you have a 3% growth rate in perpetuity with an 8% cost of capital, 100 divided by 8 minus 3, it's a growing perpetuity, gives me 2 billion as the value of my firm. Let's say I have a billion in debt, I subtract out the debt, the value of my equity is a billion, I divide by the shares outstanding, 100 million shares, I get a value per share of $10. Very simple, right? Let's say that this company now gives 10 million options, which are at the money. You know what that means? The exercise price is set equal to $10 to its CEO. My question is a very simple one. What effect will that action have on your value per share? Will it leave it unchanged because the options are at the money? Will it decrease the value by roughly 10% because the number of shares basically went up by roughly 10 million if you count those shares that will get exercised? Will it decrease by less than 10 million? Because the options will bring in cash. Let's take the first one. How many of you think that the options will have no effect on my value? Okay. Perry, do you think they'll have no effects on my value? And so let's take that to the logical extreme. If you said A, then you know what? I'm going to give my CEO 100 million options. After all, you said, if I give options at the money, you're not affected. What if I give them a billion options? You see where this is going to lead me? If you tell me that anytime I grant at the money options, you don't care, I'm going to keep granting options like that free currency. And they affect value because even though they're at the money today, you've given the CEO the next 10 years to play the game. He's not going to exercise the options today. You know when he's going to exercise them? Is when the stock price gets up to $25 or $30 and you're sitting there pretty, he's going to come in and exercise the billion options. The reason I'm not going to pick on you for picking A is that's what accountants told companies till 2007. They said, if you grant at the money options, they're worth nothing. And because they're worth nothing, you can grant as many. It's absurd. It's beyond absurd. And guess what? Companies gave options like they were free currency. It almost destroyed companies in the process. So starting in 2007, accountants have been doing the right thing. We'll talk about what the right thing is, but the one answer that is not right there is that your stock will not be affected. How much will be affected is what we're going to examine. I'm going to give you three different ways of dealing with options. The first is what's called the bludgeon approach. Here's what you do. You can get the $100 billion equity value like you did before, but you adjust just the number of shares. So what you do is you adjust the share count. It's called a diluted share count for potential options outstanding. What does that do? It increases my share count by up to 110 million and it gives me a value per share of $9.09. And what you're missing with this approach is, of course, that when those options get exercised, remember, the person exercising the option has to pay $10 per option, which means if all these options get exercised, which is what you're implicitly assuming here, there'll be 100 million in cash coming in. That's easy enough to factor in, right? In fact, the second approach, that's all you do, is you bring in the 100 million in cash into the numerator. That's the 10 million options with a $10 exercise price, you divide by the 110 million shares, and with the treasury stock approach, you basically value options as based on what their exercise value is. And guess what? You get the answer, it doesn't affect you. Maybe this is what accountants used to justify, hey, options have no value. But here's a challenge for you. Go to the CBOE, an option exchange, and try to buy an at-the-money option with 3 months. 3 months, forget about the 10 years. 3 months left to expiration at the exercise value, which will be nothing. You're not going to find it. There's a time premium on an option. So the third approach, what you do is you value the options as options. Sounds fancy, but use an option pricing model to value the options. You subtract out the estimated value of the options from your overall value of equity. And then you divide by the actual numbers. Don't mess with the number of shares outstanding. They haven't changed. You get a value per share. In my view, this is the right thing to do because it factors in options as options. And in this case, I have to use an option pricing model to value the options. And that troubles some people for a simple reason. We'll talk more about option pricing later in this class. But option pricing models were designed to value listed options, 3 month options, short term options, and employee options are really long term. They're often exercised before expiration because employees can't liquid, they can't sell the options. So when we use option pricing models to value employee options, we're pushing the envelope. And for a long time, accountants use this as an argument for not using option pricing. I know we're getting to the end of the session, so I won't go into the details, but I think we can adapt option pricing models. In fact, every one of my DCF spreadsheets tries to do it, of valuing the options as options and subtracting it from the value of equity. So when we come back from the break, we will start by mopping this up, but I'm pretty much done with the mechanics of DCF, which means that if you haven't started your DCF valuation for your company, please do. This is a good time to catch up, especially if your travel plans have been thrown off. I'm sorry for that, but that basically means that you will be sitting at home with nothing to do. I've given you something to do, so I'm not expecting gratitude, but no, don't be too pissed off that I gave you something to do. But try to get your DCF off the ground, and I'll send you a couple more emails before I give you that 1 week break. But thank you very much for listening in, and I hope you enjoyed the session. Any final questions before we stop?